You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
From the day the exhibit Alexander McQueen's Savage Beauty opened in May, it's been setting attendance records at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and as a result, it's been extended until August 7th. It chronicles the career of the influential and sometimes controversial fashion designer who died last year and includes some 100 ensembles and 70 accessories, along with videos of his runway shows. I'm very pleased to welcome the Costume Institute's curator, Andrew Bolton, who organized the Alexander McQueen show and wrote the accompanying catalog to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
When did you begin planning this exhibit? Was it something, was it before he killed himself, or is it something that his friends and colleagues wanted to do after he died?
Well, originally we had an idea of doing a trilogy of exhibitions called Against Nature, based on the Huysmans novel, that was going to focus on three designers that had idealized a female body, and McQueen was going to be the last in that series. And then when he died, we decided instead to do a retrospective of his work, really to celebrate his contributions to fashion history. So it was very much a direct response to his death.
And how do you choose the pieces for this, and where do you get them?
The majority of the pieces came from the archive in London, the McQueen Archive, and that was one of the reasons why we did the show so early after his suicide. We were very nervous. We weren't quite sure what was going to happen to the archive in London, and it was critical to have access to that in its entirety for the exhibition. And also, McQueen worked very heavily with close-knit collaborators, and we also wanted to work with them to, in a way, we felt it would give the show more integrity.
Well, many of these designs are gorgeous, fabulous, but you can't imagine people actually wearing them. Are any of them in private collections?
There are a lot. I mean, one of McQueen's greatest fans was Isabella Blow, the stylist, and she bought his MA graduation collection. And that was subsequently been bought by Daphne Guinness. So Daphne Guinness is also a great client. People like Naomi Campbell, Lady Gaga, a lot of women who are very emphatic in their choice of clothes.
But a designer like McQueen would do certain things to startle people, get attention, and then do other things that might be a bit more conventional?
That's right, yeah. He was always a great provocateur from the beginning of his career. And a lot of the pieces you see in the exhibition are finale pieces, which were designed primarily for the runway. But if you go through all of McQueen's shows, there are a lot of wearable clothes that people can pick from to wear. But we focused on the more exaggerated silhouettes.
But because they're art and they really look perfect at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. it's almost like looking at the armor and thinking how beautifully made that stuff was.
I think it's,
we don't have to go out and joust.
I think it's interesting because I think that one of the major criticisms of seeing fashion in museums is that it's no longer on a living body and it's not in movement. But I think the advantage is that you see it in such close detail. So you do see the extraordinary technical abilities of McQueen.
His family and friends called him Lee. Why did he use Alexander McQueen as his professional name?
Well, there's several stories. One is the fact that Isabella Blow, the mentor, asked him to change it. But the story that I think is more accurate is the fact that when he was working, he was still signing on. He was claiming Social Security. So by calling
himself on the dole.
And so I think by calling himself Alexander, he wasn't as traceable as as Lee McQueen.
Well, how long did that happen? Why was he poor?
Well, I think that in the early 90s, the fashion scene in London was rather depressed. And McQueen very much did dip a lot of energy back into the London fashion scene. So there wasn't very much money being given to young designers at the time.
And he got his training not by going to fashion school, but just working for tailors?
Yeah, we had a bit interesting background. He left school at 16 with just one qualification in art. And his first job was at a tailor's in Savile Row, Anderson & Shepherd, who make all the suits for Prince Charles and the royal family. And he was there for 2 years, focusing mainly on coats, on jackets. Then he moved to Gives and Hawkes, also on Savile Row, where he was focused on military tailoring.
Was he designing or was he cutting the fabric?
He was cutting, so he was learning how to use tailoring skills. And what's interesting when you look through the exhibition, and he would often say that every design he created was informed by his tailoring. So it had a huge impact on his career.
Isn't it said that he didn't have to measure, that he could just do the cutting by eye?
He had an extraordinary eye, and I only met him a couple of times, and one time was when we did a show called Anglomania in the Metropolitan Museum, and as I was showing him around, his eye kept darting to one particular piece, literally about 100 yards away from where we were talking, and one of his pieces, and when he got up close to it, there was one pleat out of place, and he saw it 100 yards away. So he had the most acute eye for detail.
Can you tell us the story of Prince Charles's jacket?
Yeah, well, the story, which has become, I think it's apocryphal, unfortunately, is that while he was working on a jacket for Anderson Shepherd, he wrote obscenities in the lining of the of his jacket. But I actually called up the tailors when I was working on the exhibition and asked them about that story. And they said that they actually called back all the jackets that McQueen had worked on, and there's nothing inside. So unfortunately, it's a myth.
Well, so he's working for tailors and he's cutting fabric. That's a big leap to then designing for yourself.
Yeah, well, after Savile Row, he worked for a costumier called Angels and Burmans, which is where he learnt his love of history, I think. And then from there, he went to Romeo Gigli in Milan and came back and actually applied for a pattern cutting job, should I say, at Central School of St. Martin's, the big MA school for fashion. And the MA director was so impressed by his portfolio, gave him a position on the MA graduation course, which is how he really started.
And then how long before he was hired to design for the House of Givenchy?
Only 5 years after graduating, so in 1996. So he'd done probably about 9 or 10 collections after graduating, and then he was hired to be the head designer at Givenchy.
It's interesting that he replaced John Galliano, who is also kind of British. He was born in Gibraltar, if I remember correctly, and no longer is employable, but that's a whole other matter. Was it common for the French to hire British designers to head French couturier?
Well, it's interesting. I think that John had a very similar career trajectory as McQueen. He also trained at Central St. Martin's College of Art and set up his own practice. And was hired initially by Givenchy, then he went to Dior. I think what's interesting about English designers is that they're very narrative-based. So they tell these incredible stories through their fashions. And you see that in the exhibition, and John also does the same thing. So I think it's very attractive as a couture company to have these designers who have to tell these wonderful stories and these fantastical stories through their fashions.
My guest is Andrew Bolton, who organized the Alexander McQueen Savage Beauty Show. That's at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and runs through August 7th. And we have a slideshow that you might check out on our show page at WNYC.org. Obviously not everything, but you'll get a taste of just the fabulous invention of Alexander McQueen. And you mentioned the narrative. He gave his shows, his collections, titles. And some of them are rather horrifying. Jack the Ripper stalks his victims. Highland Rape. Widows of Culloden. It's a jungle out there.
A lot of his collections were actually autobiographical. So even the Jack the Ripper stalks his victims told a story of one of his ancestors owned an inn that housed one of the victims of Jack the Ripper. So a lot of his collections did tell personal stories.
And they're about death. There are lots of skulls in his work. So was he obsessed by death? Or should we be surprised that he later killed himself?
I think he loved the romance of death. He was almost like a romantic artist or writer of the 19th century. He loved these polarities in life, like life and death, good and evil, heaven and hell. And his collections are very much about reconciling those polarities in his work.
And when he says Jack the Ripper, he's really telling us that this collection has some reference to the Victorian era. There's another one that would tell us it's about the Scottish Highlands, and he actually used tartans in those?
That's right. The one you mentioned earlier, which was Highland Rape, and that caused such a furore when it was launched in England because it had the word rape in the title, and the collection had models staggering down the runway which were blood-spattered. So the immediate response was that it was about the rape of women, but it was about the rape of Scotland.
And so he was making a political statement there.
Absolutely.
The work does look at times like wearable sculpture. Mm-hmm. Was that part of his philosophy? Was he thinking as a sculptor rather than as a fashion designer sometimes?
I think he was thinking as an artist. I think that he often used unorthodox materials like shells. There's one dress in the exhibition that's made from razor clam shells. And he almost had this sort of fetishistic, shamanistic approach to materials. And I think what's interesting about McQueen is how he would embed emotion into his clothes.
So how do you organize an exhibit like this?
This was tricky because it was so soon after his death. There was a lot of emotion around the idea of doing the exhibition. And almost from the beginning, I didn't want to do a chronological retrospective.
Although the first gallery does feature some of his early designs.
It does. And it actually has two pieces from his MA graduation collection, the Jack the Ripper Stalks His Victims. And they're extraordinary. I think what's amazing about those pieces, one piece is a coat called the three-point origami frock coat, which was a silhouette that McQueen would revisit throughout his entire career. So McQueen was such an assured, confident designer that as early as his graduation collection, he was establishing his forms and silhouettes.
That gallery also includes his infamous bumster skirts and trousers, which show a bit of, quote, bum cleavage. That's before the gangster look took on so much significance in this country.
I think that the bumpsters was probably one of his most famous designs and also a design that had the biggest impact on the high street. It really did spur the trend for having very low-slung jeans and pants.
But it was also a way of calling attention to himself, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And I think the early collections were very much about garnering attention and publicity, totally.
And you mentioned some of the clamshells. There are lots of feathers, leather, metal. It was also important for him to include things that you don't normally find. Well, feathers you do, but absolutely, not as many feathers as you do in an Alexander McQueen outfit.
Yeah, he was obsessed by feathers, and I think that also exacerbated after he was at Givenchy. At Givenchy, he learnt all the skills of the Petitman workshops, like embroidery and featherwork and lacework. And his work after Givenchy became much more couture-like in its aesthetic.
So the tartan plaids, for example, a way of exploring his Scottish roots?
They were, definitely. They were part of the McQueen clan tartan. And he often, when he looked back into Scottish history, he often looked at the more turbulent parts of Scottish history, like the Jacobite risings of the 18th century or the Highland clearances of the 19th century. So it's very much the darker side of the Scottish history that he was interested in.
And then his 2005 collection, It's Only a Game, imagines a chess match between America and Japan.
that piece.
I wonder where these things come from.
That actually was inspired by Harry Potter. McQueen took inspiration from everywhere. Like he was voracious in terms of his consumption of high and low culture. And famously, he designed one whole collection based on a green sweater worn by the character Joey in the sitcom Friends.
He also has, you have a gallery called the Cabinet of Curiosities, which has jewelry, corsets, shoes, and headpieces. I'm assuming he collaborated with others.
He did.
And the shoemakers especially, the milliners. But those shoes, could anybody ever wear any of those shoes?
Well, there's one famous shoe, which is part of his last collection, called the Armadillo shoe, which is worn by Lady Gaga in her video Bad Romance.
It looks like claws.
It looks like claws. It's like a hoof. And it was actually inspired by a ballet pump being on point. That's the inspiration behind it. So, but McQueen was all about making women taller and longer. So by having, even the bumpsters were all about making a longer torso.
Were his collections successful commercially? Was he good at the business side of fashion?
He was, and he took a lot of interest in the business side of fashion, particularly after Gucci bought the company, or at least half the company, in 2000.
So here he is, a big star, and then he commits suicide at the age of 40.
Yes, it was so sad. I think that it's a great loss to the fashion community. I think what was extraordinary about McQueen is that he was able to marry the technical part of his craft with the conceptual side. So, he really was a true artist.
Do we know why he killed himself?
We don't know. And
his mother had just died.
His mother just died, and people often say that it was a response to that. But there was an interview in The Guardian newspaper in England that was conducted by his mother, and his mother said, "What's your greatest fear?" And he said, "Dying before you." So in a way, it was almost as if his mother's death gave him the ability to do his own.
Some fashion houses survive the death of their their founders. Where does his company go from here?
Well, it's extraordinary. It's been taken over by Sarah Burton, who made Kate Middleton's wedding dress. And Sarah had been with McQueen for 14 years, eight of them as head of his women's wear range. And she knows McQueen's work inside out, the technical part of it, the conceptual part of it. So she really is the most obvious heir to his legacy.
And does the work look similar?
It's similar, but it definitely has Sarah's stamp, more feminine, softer, lighter, in a way more wearable.
And no shells on Kate Middleton's dress.
No shells, just embroidery.
You've been opening on Mondays for people willing to pay a premium to see the show, but it still is mobbed pretty much all the time, and it's been extended until August 7th. Could it be extended again?
Oh, I'd love it to, but unfortunately we have another exhibition coming in afterwards, so it's not possible, I'm afraid.
Will it be travelling?
Not at the moment, but I think there are plans for a show eventually to occur in London. Probably not in the same format as it is now, but probably an exhibition.
Meanwhile, we have a little over a month to see it still. It's at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it's called Alexander McQueen, Savage Beauty. And my great thanks to Andrew Bolton, who organized the exhibit, for being on our show today.
Thank you very much.